Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. So go to thestagelefpodcast.com for all episodes featuring members of Kraftwerk, The 1975, Bastille, Elbow, Gorillaz, Smashing Pumpkins, Queen, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Earth, Wind and Fire, Guns N' Roses and Radiohead, who discuss their writing, recording and performing processes, as well as reflective interviews with musicians and producers who've worked in the studio and on stage with Stormzy, ABBA, Michael Jackson, The Beatles, Beyonce, Elvis and David Bowie. Today we'll be discussing creativity with the mind of Toucan, drummer and producer with international banging tune makers, Super Organism, one of the most creative, ingenious, innovative, inventive, experimental original bands of recent times, often using extremely random objects as instruments as a backdrop to colourful pop perfection. So it's a pleasure to say that guest down the Stage Left podcast is none other than Toucan. Thanks for joining us today, Toucan. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for having me, man. You've got quite an impressive list of people so far you've talked to, so glad to be involved.
Great stuff, and we're going to add to that list with you today. Now, the question you probably hear quite a lot, and I think it's really important for listeners who don't know too much about Super Organism, is that you all met online, right? Now, on reflection, what do you think the advantages and disadvantages of kind of forming a band online might be, given that it's probably likely to happen more and more going forward?
While we did meet online, a lot of us were in the same country in New Zealand, so, I mean, we kind of met online, but it wasn't like an online collaboration thing at first. I mean, you get to meet more people from just your immediate circles, but I mean, at the other extreme, if you become a band and then you start touring, it becomes a kind of tough thing to make work in terms of like flying people around the world or time zones and working together. So it's got pluses and minuses. Yeah, as a touring entity, it's tough. Definitely.
In what way?
Just the cost, you know, every time we do something, we've got to fly people around and,
yeah,
that. If we have a meeting with someone, we've got to make it work in the different time zones. And sometimes that's three different time zones, like Australia and UK and Japan, sometimes America as well. So,
wow.
Yeah. In hindsight, maybe it wasn't the best idea, but, you know, we made it work.
And it makes you really, really unique. And obviously, you've got kind of loads of different influences coming from different places. For you specifically growing up, what was the artist you were most excited about when they released a new piece of music?
New piece of music. I mean, I was like a huge Weezer fan as a kid. That was kind of my big one. And I love those first two albums, but then as they kind of released subsequent ones, I must say I lost interest a bit. But yeah, those were kind of that was the big one for me. A lot of like 90s kind of stuff. It was a lot of things that had already kind of, I guess, come out by the time I was listening to them, like they were a few years old. But I guess at the same time, like Oasis and that kind of stuff. In New Zealand in the late 90s, there was like British MTV was free to air for some reason for like a couple of years. And so that was like the tail end of Britpop. And that was pretty cool. Like Pulp and stuff like that. I suppose that had already come out, some of that stuff. But yeah, a lot of rock music, basically.
What was your favorite Oasis record?
I'm going to say Morning Glory. I know Definitely Maybe's great, but I'm still going to say Morning Glory.
What's so special about that particular album for you?
Maybe at my age, I guess when it came out, I particularly liked the title track, Morning Glory. I think I listened to that one before I listened to Definitely Maybe as well. I kind of went backwards. And actually, they were the first big band I ever saw live.
And that's exactly the same as me. So the first record I bought was Morning Glory, and then I went back to Definitely
Cool.
Maybe.
Yeah.
It's probably a very formative kind of couple of albums for me. Where did you see them live?
I saw them at the Event Centre in Wellington in 1998, and that was the Be Here Now tour. And they were shit.
Really?
And it put me off them for several years before I got back into them.
What was it about that particular gig that made them didn't work here?
They, you know, that I think that point in their time was the kind of the height of their, obviously the height of their fame at that point, but also I think the relationship between the brothers, they stormed off stage at one point. They seemed a bit bored. I think they were probably annoyed they couldn't get Coke in New Zealand or something. The venue is horrible. It's like a tin shed that's like a sports arena, so it sounded really bad. Yeah, to be honest, I was really disappointed, but
wow.
Gave it a couple of years and I was fully back into it.
And what other what other gigs kind of growing up really were formative gigs that you kind of stood there and went, maybe I want to do some of this stuff? Like, you know, I think all of us listening to this podcast probably went to a gig at some point and was like, wow, that's kind of pivotal in my life. If I hadn't gone to this gig, life wouldn't exactly pan out the way it has. What was one for you?
That's a tough question, because for me, it was always records, not live music. I started listening to records when I was way younger, like before I could go to live shows. Like, my sister took me to Oasis. My sisters are quite a bit older than me. So when I was like 6 years old, they were like 14 and 16, and they were showing me like music. Like, I remember they had like the Triple J compilations at Australian radio station. And I remember they had like Radiohead and the Breeders and that kind of stuff on it. Ween, love Ween. Yeah, and so I kind of fell in love with records more, you know. So by the time I went and saw Oasis when I was, must have been like 13 or something like that, I was already like really into records. And then I started going to shows, and I got to say, I was often also disappointed.
Interesting.
Compared to the records, you know, because you fall in love with a certain version of the way it sounds and the way it's played and all that, and then you see it live and it's different. And, you know, sometimes it's an amazing experience, of course, but I don't know if there was any hugely formative ones. There's been some great shows I've been to over the years, but I don't think I ever had that magic moment at a show. It was always a magic moment in my bedroom listening to a record. Always.
Now, given you play live across the world and tour across the world now, like, how does that feed into your thinking when you're putting a show together, right, live now? So what are you trying to achieve that was perhaps missing when you went as a 13-year-old?
It has to be really good.
And okay, how do you define good? So that's subjective, right? So good in what
way? I guess we try and do what we can to make it sound as good as possible and make the show interesting. I guess that's it, yeah. I also know that that's kind of my weird opinion about maybe live music, that I know like a lot of people love it, and, you know, it's a thing that people really enjoy. But for me, it was, yeah, again, the records were always the special thing for me, and, yeah, it's hard to describe.
That's fascinating, because also that's going to feed, that's part of your DNA as someone who's now putting on like these great live shows. And it's kind of interesting how you kind of compare and contrast what you saw as a 13-year-old, what you're doing now, and to say, okay, so this wasn't so good, but this is what good looks like. And I do think that your band are particularly interesting live and particularly innovative, and it's very, very captivating to watch. You never know quite what's going to happen next. And as I mentioned in the intro, kind of, you know, some of the stuff you've done with the instruments that you use, which we're going to come on to in a little while, it's just so fascinating. And so maybe that kind of fed into, you know, it's interesting to use the word boring. You're kind of bored watching some of these bands. And it's like, well, actually, you know, this is that's kind of the antithesis and the kind of opposite of what you do live. So it's kind of interesting to explore that.
Maybe it was also because that New Zealand was at the tail end of like international tours, and so by the time the band gets there, it's the end of the tour. They're bored, like maybe.
Quite possibly.
But sometimes it's the start of the tour. I saw the Pavement reunion shows. When was that? Like late 2000s, and it was the first. Like, it was the first place they played. That was fantastic. And I've definitely been to some great live shows. I'm not trying to like write off.
So you got
live
to bring
music.
Back the Pavement reference there, because obviously Stephen Mount was played on your last record.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
So that must have been quite a surreal moment, having been and seen him play live in the early 2000s, and then, you know, recording with you. Here's a question I've got about this: is that, you know, obviously you're a very competent guy, and you've done some amazing stuff in the music industry. But when you are working with someone who has a bit of a profile and that you've kind of seen from through the lens of being a fan, if you like, and then you're working with them, how do you stay centered amongst that and allow still great creativity to happen in that situation without being kind of put off by the fact that you were once a fan?
Yeah, you just can't be fazed. I mean, he's a nice guy. Like, we got to meet him first as well. I think that's the thing, is that everyone we've had as a guest has been people that we've got to meet first, and that's why they've become a guest on the record. You know, we just kind of built an actual friendship with them, and so it feels more natural when you actually come to collaborate. But with Stephen, we just like let him do what he wanted, and then we cut it, like, very drastically cut it all up and pieced it together and made something quite strange out of it. That, like, his rap didn't actually rap that quite like that. We really, really cut it up.
How did he find it? How was his response when he heard it?
He loved it, yeah. Yeah, he's keen. He's keen to have it on there. So, yeah, that's the thing. You've always got to go back to be like, hey, so this is what we've got. Are you keen? And he's like, yep.
Love it. Was anyone, when it became apparent that you're going in, you know, you're going to become a musician and you're doing this, you know, a few years ago and things are blowing up, was anyone who was kind of like, a bit apprehensive about you going into the music industry in any way? Like, were they like, you should be getting a proper job? And I put that in inverted commas, because a lot of our young listeners get that, right? So a lot of our listeners right now are in this position. They could be the next David Bowie, they could be the next John Lennon, whoever it might be, but they're also under pressure to pay their bills and the pressure from parents or family members who are like, well, you need to get a proper job as well. How did you navigate that kind of tension?
My parents are always very supportive, but at the same time, kind of like, you've got to be realistic, you know, like, it's very hard to make a career in music, and especially in New Zealand. I mean, obviously that's part of why I left, but I guess that they for years, mum was kind of like, oh, you should get a job in IT and do, you're good at computer stuff, you should get a job in that. And Superorganism was the end of her finally saying that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult thing to navigate, right? And a lot of people might pressure in, you know, feel pressure to, okay, I'll go and do an IT course. And they will, you know, in fact, I don't know if you know, there's a rapper in the UK called Dave who's doing some amazing stuff. Yeah. And like, he actually sings about it on some of his songs.
Oh, cool.
And did like a little course like on like finance and accounting and stuff like that. And it's just kind of like an interesting balance and in how you kind of navigate that world, because there will be, you know, we might be losing like great musicians to that pressure, right? We might not hear the next like Sgt. Pepper's record because that is lost to someone going doing a kind of a full-time job. So I think it's an interesting thing to kind of explore.
Well, I was also foolishly trying to do two music jobs, because as well as like writing, producing, I mix and engineer as well. And so I was always recording other bands and doing that. And of course, that's also another very hard thing to make a living in. So I was kind of working a full-time job and recording bands and playing in bands. Just staying, very busy.
Yeah, and that's probably the best way to go. So you've got lots of kind of different income streams and stuff like that if you can. Let's talk about production. So when it comes to you as a producer and you're working with an artist, perhaps for the first time, what's your kind of philosophy as a producer? Like, every producer has kind of a bit of a mantra or philosophy about how they want to get, you know, how they want to create an environment so that people can thrive in that environment. What's your philosophy as a producer?
That's hard to say again as well. So I've only really produced my own bands. Working with outside artists, I've generally always been just an engineer, just a mixer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that started with like recording local bands back in the day. They didn't want a producer. They just wanted someone to like press record and help them choose tones and whatever. But in my own bands, I've always taken on the production role. Philosophy behind it, I don't know. I want to make something that I'd like to listen to and that just feels good and flows well. And just be like a bouncing board for the other band members, because it's always been a case of like several of us have been the producers, I've been the engineer, but several of us have kind of taken on the production role.
Yeah. And with that, so you've obviously, you know, there's a quite a big age gap between some of you in Superorganism. How do you get the best, or how do you as a collective ensure you get the best out of each other? Are there particular things like individually that people need to be in place to be able to really smash a particular take? Is it someone, you know, someone needs lots of takes? Is someone else is kind of like, actually, I just want to put pressure on one? Like, what are the dynamics in within the band around how they thrive best in those recordings?
We all work in isolation, basically. We're not really sitting in the room together. We have a little bit, like on tour, but no, usually you send it off and we all, I think for me at least, I like to take my time. I'm not maybe great in the room. I like to kind of have my own time to probably go over it and maybe make some mistakes, and then I'll rectify it and figure something out. I think Harry's the same. Arno will literally do three takes, and those are the takes that are used in the song.
Wow, nice.
Very consistent. Should do like three very consistent vocal takes, and you know, one of them will be the verse, and then three of them combined together will be the chorus or something. Yeah, so I think. Working separately does work for us. I think it's a slow way of working, again, especially with the time zones, but it seems to work for us.
And what fascinates me about this, there was a band actually based in Brighton in the UK, you might not have heard them, called Electric Soft Parade, around a few years ago. And
no.
They once recorded a record and they were like, we're deliberately not going to think whilst we're recording how on earth we're going to play this live, right? And then when it came to the stage of having to play it live, they were like, holy fuck, how are we even going to begin to try and pull this off live? Right, so is that ever in the back of your mind, thinking, okay, how's this going to translate to live? Probably not in the first record, but after that, it might kind of seep in a little bit that you've got to play this stuff live.
That was something that I was always obsessed with when I was much younger, like making rock music, like, oh, we can't add a synth because we don't have a synth. We can't play that live kind of thing.
Wow.
But I don't know. I guess over time listening to records and going to shows and seeing how people do it, it was kind of like, they're just different experiences. There's like, you know, it's kind of a silly thing. You really should make the record be as best as it can be. And then, yeah, figure it out later. And the reason like this band started was because we'd been playing in like a rock band, some of us that no one was interested in. And so we decided, you know, let's not play live. Let's just like make this internet band with friends from all around the world and we'll just kind of release music online and that's it. Let's not worry about live shows. So that was never a consideration from the get-go of how will we do this. And then, yeah, suddenly we got a bunch of interest and we had to figure out how are we going to do this. Second record, I don't know. I think we decided with the second record for this touring, it was going to be more DJ based in terms of the live setup. Still some live instruments, but yeah, like more DJ based. So that was luckily because, you know, the new stuff is very packed.
When you sat down and kind of, you know, it's like, wow, we've become kind of international pop sensation, right? After the first record. Didn't see that coming, but here we go. It's happened. So what are we going to do now? That's such an interesting conversation. Like it's actually, you know, it's...
Yeah, second conscious. Record. Second yeah. record. We wanted to make something that kind of sounded grander, which I think it does. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously like production-wise, very widescreen and just full on. We've kind of said that this is actually what we wanted the first record to kind of sound like, but we didn't know how to do it. And then I guess like more personal lyrically, I'm not really a huge lyric person. So that might be a question for Arno, but I think it's a bit more personal. It's kind of more emo sounding. I always kind of think of it like it's our Pinkerton. And so maybe in 10 years it'll be appraised better than it has been.
Yeah. And I mean, this is what's really interesting, I think, for me. So you're in the studio, you're recording this piece kind of separately, and then you see yourselves on like Times Square. So there's like pictures of you, you know, in Times Square. And this is what's interesting. So think about this, you know, a lot of our listeners are going to be young musicians who kind of want to get to the stage that you are at. What advice would you give for people who actually go through that journey and start getting recognized? That must be such a strange situation for you to... I know it, obviously with the previous band as well, that would have happened a little bit, but
no,
it's a strange... Right, okay.
Not at all.
I
think we straddle an area where like we've had success but not like household name success. So I think while Arno would probably get recognized more, the rest of us really haven't been. Aside from, like, if you're at a festival and you're walking around, people sometimes recognize you. But the only other time I swear I've been recognized in the street was that once we had a meeting with our accountant and we came out of the office in central London. Some, like, girls were like, oh, hey, super organist. We were like, oh, cool. Yeah, I mean, I think you need to be quite famous to be recognized like that. So it seems surreal to see yourself on a billboard. Like, for this album process, we had a big billboard that was up in... Shoreditch for a while, and I've walked past it several times and I kind of like laughing in my head walking past like, oh, that's me on that billboard up there, but I'm just walking down the street and like no one knows who the hell I am.
And I think that's kind of that's kind of nice. I mean,
it is in some ways
it's the perfect place you want to be, right? That you get kind of, you don't get followed by paparazzi or anything like that. You can actually just get those experiences. And
yeah, I mean, I'd love to be more successful, but I also hate to have paparazzi outside my front door. That'd be horrible.
So successful was such an interesting word to me. So yeah. Bob Dylan once said that success was going to bed at night, getting up in the next morning and basically doing what you want for that day, right? That is the definition of success, that you can just do what you enjoy doing.
Yeah, I think so.
What about from your perspective? So what does successful look like from your perspective?
I mean, we get to do what we love and make a living doing it. So I think that's, I don't have to have, well, I mean, I have two jobs, I guess. I've got the band and then my mixing. But, you know, I don't have to have a day job, which is awesome. I get to do this for a job, which I'm very, very lucky. So, yeah, to me, that would be success. Of course, it'd be great to be doing better, but, you know, we're making it work. So that's a huge kind of thing.
And so let's get into the live room. So obviously you played live, you know, for you know, 10 years or so, and superorganisms is a very different kind of thing to what you're doing previously. Let's talk about some of the most high profile shows that you've played. So I you'll be able to answer that, but I remember seeing on Jules Holland and thinking, wow, like that was fantastic, and there's so much that was interesting about that particular performance. That's obviously a massive step up, in regards to pressure and that kind of thing. Talk us through what you did maybe to ensure that you were in the right place as soon as they went right, or as soon as Jules is saying right now, superorganism. What did you do to make sure that you were in the right place mentally and kind of physically to give that great performance?
They must have overdubbed it because he actually in the room said super orgasm, which was quite funny. That was scary as hell, man. Like, I don't think we'd actually played a show at that point. I think that was our first show, which was, scary. And we pre-recorded two songs, but then we did the one that was live and I was shaking.
Really?
Because I knew how many people were tuned in. And our setup as well is like very Ableton based. And at that point, our setup was brand new and it was behaving itself. But I mean, later on, that wasn't the case. But yeah, it was just like, I don't know how we prepped for it. We rehearsed a lot and then we did it and it kind of seemed like a blur. And then as soon as we finished, it was just like, oh, thank God that went well, because it was nerve-wracking.
It's quite an iconic performance. I mean, the most stark thing is obviously, you know, you've got a singer who looks so,
She was 17 at the time,
absolutely, and she looked younger, I'd say. So it's like, wow, this is such an original, and I thought it was such a Jules band to have got on. You know, it's the first time I saw you guys, and it was like,
cool,
okay, right, this is, you know, it's so original with something so different, and the kind of the dancing and that kind of thing, you know. But you absolutely nailed that performance. Really interesting.
Thank you.
That you were shaking and nervous, like that didn't come across at all.
Okay, that's good.
And then again, I guess I hadn't seen a comparison beforehand, but like, you guys just seemed like in the zone. What are the other ones that you kind of felt most pumped for? Any kind of TV performances or live shows that you were kind of particularly pumped for?
Probably not TV stuff apart from that. I mean, we played Coachella, which was really cool. I think by that point we played a lot of shows, so it wasn't like nerve wracking in the same way, but it was still like awesome to be able to play that. There's a few. I think one of the first big festivals we played was All Points East in East London, and that was like the first time we played in front of like a maybe 5,000 capacity crowd, so that was a real buzz. Same as Corona Capital, Mexico City, which I think was like 10,000 people. It was so loud, that was crazy. You know, when you hear the roar of it before you walk on, you're like, whoa. And again, you're like, I hope our equipment doesn't break, because we had that a lot. That's probably the most nerve-wracking part of it, was that we had an unstable system.
And that's so interesting, because that's going to create so much anxiety and almost like maybe excitement potentially as well. It's like, could it go wrong? Could it go? Tell us about when it did go wrong and what do you do in that situation?
So many times. So the way our setup worked is that everything ran through Ableton. All the drums were triggers running into an SPD, mesh heads in the drums, so the drums are silent. And that all runs into Ableton. All the samples are in Ableton. All the keyboard stuff is in Ableton. The lead vocal runs through Ableton for the processing. So if it goes down, everything goes down, except for the mic on the hi-hat and the crash and the three backup vocalists. Otherwise, everything goes down. And it did many, many times, which at first was really scary, but we just kind of like, got really good at being able to be like, god damn it, like our thing broke. And she'd like talk while our tech would frantically be like, oh shit, like make it work.
I mean, yeah,
she did.
She saved kind of everyone's skin. I mean, that's great that she was able to do that.
She really rose to the occasion on that, because that's like you know, we're mid-song and just suddenly cut, like gone, nothing. It was just it was just not a great system. And because it was like being toured in a Pelly case that was being in check-in luggage and getting battered around, and it didn't hold up. But we've replaced it now. We've got a rock solid rig.
And now you've got that rock solid. Like, does that kind of change your kind of focus when you're playing live? Like in those early shows, where you, a part of your brain was thinking, you know, what have I got to troubleshoot this issue technically? But now,
I mean,
you focus more.
The very early shows, it was stable, so it was okay. It was kind of the later shows, like halfway through the first album touring. So I'm not playing drums anymore, because I'm not really a drummer, and like, because it was like the mesh heads and the triggers, it wasn't like, it's not like playing a real kit. You've got no dynamics. It's just like playing Rock Band kind of. So we were kind of getting out of the idea of doing that and going towards more of a DJ setup, which is I'm kind of DJing it and playing some keys now. But yeah, so we've got a more reliable setup. We don't have a backline tech anymore. I'm just doing it because I know the setup inside and out and I feel more confident about running it. So, and it's been solid and it's a smaller little rig that is a carry-on luggage size now. So it doesn't get thrown around, which is a big thing. But we've got redundancy. We've got two laptops that run it, which we did in the last setup too. But I mean, it didn't seem to work. But yeah, so the anxiety's kind of gone. I'm a lot more relaxed on stage this time. But I think that's partially because I'm not playing drums. And also, yeah, because I can trust our setup.
Interesting. And there'll be a lot of people listening to this who've been in bands and they haven't got quite to the stage where, and they may never, unfortunately, like play to 5,000 or 10,000 people. So when that actually happened, when that transition happened, talk us through kind of what surprised you in that process, because you would have observed so many people playing to large audiences in the past and not experienced it. Like, what's that? What surprised you? And talk us through that kind of
surprise stage.
Yeah,
it's weird how like the first time you play like an extra, like a bigger one than you played previously, there's a real buzz, and you're like, "Whoa, it's such a crazy experience." But it's funny how quick you adjust to it. I can see why like bands who play stadiums love to go and change and go play like a small venue again, because I guess you get used to it in a way. It gets like the big venues get very echoey, which I kind of find strange. I don't know. It's, I guess you don't kind of make eye contact with people in the crowd as much, because usually there's a barrier, they're further away. So it feels a bit more anonymous, but also like the energy of the crowd still feeds back in a different way, especially for, I think, the guys up front. I don't know. I think we're on our own little world. I'm also just kind of sitting there, even though I'm less stressed now, just being like, oh, I hope nothing goes wrong. I hope it all works. Let's get through it.
It's fascinating because there's, you know, there's so many people who want to be in that position. It's nice that you've kind of done that transition. You've kind of done that journey. And that will, I would honestly think that's just going to kind of, those thousands are going to kind of just expand going forward for you guys. There was 4 years between your records. And I think this is a really interesting thing from kind of producer point of view, also from an engineer point of view, but also as an artist. Were you given a deadline? And
nah.
Right. Okay, so that's interesting. So you weren't given a deadline. Do you think like you would have benefited, or like the record would have been, you know, I mean, it's great. Like, where do you think the fact that it didn't have a deadline fed into how good the record was? And if you'd said, right, actually, we've got to do it in 2 years, do you think it would have been a different record? Like, how do you find as a collective working to deadlines or not working to them?
The intention was for it to be like 2 years. We didn't want to wait 4 years, and it was honestly COVID why we didn't, because there was no point releasing it if we couldn't tour it. We'd kind of made the record, but it gave us the chance to kind of really work on it more and make it again, and Domino had kind of said to us like, oh, you know, I think you guys can step it up a bit, which at first we were like, oh, damn it, like, but then, you know, a week after they tell us that, you're like, ah, they're right, you know, they're definitely right, and they were. That's when we got to work with a few different outside producers, which is a new thing for us. We got to work with Stuart Price, who's done a lot of very successful records, and John Hill as well, and a guy called Carter Lang, that was a bit earlier in the process, who's just worked on the new Scissor record. I think that time really, like, we didn't have to work on it full time, which was quite nice. We could all work on our own stuff outside of that as well, and just, like, you know, work on making the record be better. I think like when the band was first new, we had a very prolific period of like making new music and making that first album. That was done very quickly. And then we like started touring and did about 2 years of solid, very solid touring, and had very little time to work on new music. And it slowed down the, like, I guess our songwriting process. And we've never quite got back to that fast thing. This has happened to me in previous bands as well, where like the first period is very prolific and then it slows down and it becomes a much slower moving project from then on. So I think we needed the time to make it. And in hindsight, having that much longer time benefited it. It did mean that we were out of the public eye for much longer, which is tough. But then again, and then releasing it in the post-COVID, you know, it's still going, but you know, everyone's releasing records, so it was a very busy time.
So one of the questions, Scott, about this, so, and this is where you could advise a lot of people listening to this podcast, is what's your process to, as when you're self-producing stuff, that you actually go, okay, this is finished. We are no longer going to listen back and tweak anything, right? Because I, honestly, I even myself, you know, there's records I should have put out that I never did because I one more listen and it's like, no, that should be up a little bit. That should be, I'm wanting to make those tweaks. So you've worked with other producers on this album and sometimes that can kind of give away that accountability and responsibility. And that's quite, can be quite a useful thing. But if you're self-producing, at what point do you say stop?
That's tough. I'm more experienced as a mixer than a producer, and I think as a mixer I can draw that line, and that just comes down to experience. But as a producer, I totally, yeah, it's very hard to know when, and it's kind of when everyone collectively in our group is saying like, yeah, I think it's done. It doesn't help because of, you know, we've got a mixer in the band. It means that we probably mix earlier than we should, and while we're mixing, we're still producing, so that line gets very blurred. I don't know. It's hard to say. I think at some point it just feels natural. Like if everyone's still excited about the song, I think, and it feels like there's nothing more that can be done, I think that's when it's a, like, there are the songs that we worked on that just never got finished because there wasn't someone in the band driving the enthusiasm for that song. So I think that's what it takes. You need to kind of feel like it's finished, but still be enthusiastic about it. And you should be then enthusiastic to show other people and release it, I guess. Yeah. It's tough, though. It's definitely tough, you know.
It's absolutely tough, yeah.
Experience, and I think it's unfortunately, it just boils down to experience, doesn't it? Like,
particularly knowing there wasn't a deadline. You know, that's what's interesting with deadlines, stuff like that. There wasn't a deadline.
Oh, I love a deadline. Love a deadline.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting to see. If there's not a deadline, you could just end up just keep retweeting. Oh, no, that needs tweaking. Or, you know, as you say, we could add this. So it's kind of an interesting thing that okay, it needs someone who's really driving it. And also to keep, because you don't want to overproduce it to the point where everyone's kind of really bored of the song. And like, you don't have that enthusiasm as well, which is, it's kind of interesting too. So let's talk about creativity, because there's so much creativity that's kind of like pouring out of the band. What's your kind of rules around, if there are any, to ensure that things remain kind of creative and they don't get bland, because you're the opposite of bland, I would say. So what are your kind of, is there a mantra that you have as a collective?
Not really. I think we just make the music that we like. This band is kind of like where all of our music tastes cross over. All of us have very wide tastes in music, but you know, I like a bunch of metal and stuff, but that doesn't really pull itself into this project. It's kind of, yeah, where all of our tastes meet, but it's also, I guess we like to do stuff that's a bit out there and crazy and like quite kaleidoscopy and, you know, buzzy or trippy, if you will. There's no kind of real mantra. I guess we want to write good songs. I feel like if you strip away all the silly production, that you can play our songs on an acoustic guitar and sing it and they still are good songs in that traditional sense, I think. And I think that's important. Because you
that's
know the
spot on.
Because the production can't cover like a bad song, I don't think.
That's such
to make,
a great
make
point.
It more interesting, but you know, like yeah, I think the song has to come through. So I think yeah, and yeah, I think we're very lucky that especially like I'm not a lyricist, but a couple of the other guys are, and I think they always have an interesting take on things, which is important. You got something to say? Because I don't have anything to say.
Not yet. Not yet.
Not yet. Maybe one day. Maybe one day. But for now, I just go bleep bloop on the synth, and people seem to like it.
And a performance of yours that I think everyone should kind of source out and have a quick look at, even do it right now as you're listening to this, is it's on YouTube. It's so when you did South by Southwest, you're sat in a swimming pool, right? And
oh, that one,
yeah. Kind of sat around. That's by far my favorite performance.
Oh yeah,
because like people, like you got some of you like who are using water as like a percussion
instrument. Yeah,
you've got cans of like, well they're anonymous, but yeah, cans like soda cans, like using those as kind of like you know as percussion instruments as well as their opening and stuff like that. Where does that come from? Because they're so imaginative.
So the actual album, like for example, the song "Everybody Knows You're Famous" has loads of cans opening and pouring water sounds. It's meant to be champagne pouring sounds because it's meant to be like, yeah, famous. So that was us kind of being like, oh, how do we incorporate that? Obviously, we can't really do that in the big loud live show, but when you're doing more of a, I don't use the word acoustic, but when you're doing like a stripped back session, you can actually hear that kind of stuff. And so that was like an interesting way of using it. And Tiny Esk, we did the same sort of thing as well. We did that. We had a bucket of water splashing around and making fun with that. It also, it's nice to have a refreshment when you're playing. So, you know, you can put a beer in the koozie, I think they call it. I think that's an Australian word to cover the can, because, you know, the logos they always get upset about when you're filming stuff. That was kind of thrust on us, that I remember that performance. They're like, oh, we want to do an acoustic outside performance thing. We're like, oh, okay. And they're like, oh, it's going to be... I think they wanted to shoot it like in this other area, and there's like this pool right there. And we're like, nah, we'll just sit in the pool. And one of the guys had the synth on his lap and it's like plugged in. And everyone was like, it's like, nah, it'd be fine.
That was my next question. Like, it's quite, it's
don't
quite
drop,
a tense watch.
Don't drop the synth.
Yeah, it's quite a tense watch in some ways, because you just think, surely there's like someone's going to get electrocuted. How are you managing not to ensure?
Should have used a battery powered synth in hindsight, maybe. Okay. But hey, you know, got to live dangerously for rock, right?
Nice one. If I could give you the power to rewatch one of your live performances from your career from the audience's perspective, which would you choose?
I think it was our second ever show. Our first ever show was at the Reeperbahn Festival in Hamburg, but our second ever show was Village Underground in Shoreditch at about 700 cap, and we sold it out, and that was our second ever show. And again, we were all freaked out. Would have loved to have been there as an audience member just to see. That would have been quite interesting. Just because it was kind of, I mean, it wasn't our first show, but I guess it was kind of our first proper show of our own, rather than just being on a lineup where you're shoved on stage with a 10-minute changeover.
Nice. Now, Ono once said that, and this is obviously referring to the first track of your last album, but once said that music industry is just a big black hole. In which ways do you agree with that, and kind of what makes the industry a black hole? And the final question linked to that, and I will repeat these, is like, what would help make it less ominous?
I think that's her opinion. My opinion is that, like, I've been trying to work in the music industry my whole life, and I've made it happen, and it's the best thing ever. And it's tough, and you need a thick skin, but I love it. And yeah, I don't kind of agree with that.
In what ways is it tough for you? If you're happy to share, so what ways do you think?
You know, you've really got to fight and kind of like put a lot of effort and work in. And if you do that, there's no guarantee it'll pay off. You know, it's a huge amount of luck and being in the right place at the right time and stuff. You know, and being rejected and being told that you're crap. And, you know, I guess that's the tough thing, is that, you know, you might put your heart and soul into it and then no one cares. But you need to keep going, because if you don't keep going, well, then it definitely won't happen. You know, it only happens because you don't quit.
Yeah. So many listeners will be kind of attuned to that, right? So many, yeah, so many people go, I've been rejected, or I've been, you know, been told it's not going to work out, et cetera. Wow.
You just have to, you have to push through it, because, I mean, it comes from a passion. Like, if you genuinely, you see people who like the idea of wanting to do it, but they don't seem to actually enjoy it. And I think that you just have to enjoy it. And that's what kind of drives you to work a day job, but keep spending another 30 hours a week working on music rather than just sitting in your house thinking about doing it. Yeah, I mean, it's just like a drive and a passion, I guess. Like,
and where does that come from? So if you were to really analyze that, if there is a time when you really felt like,
it's like a therapy session.
Well, that's my second job, right?
So. Oh, is it? There you go. There you go.
Where's the root cause? So when you are in that kind of place where you think, oh, like, fuck this, I've got the rejection, that I put all this effort into it, you know, that's great that you've got that drive. Like, where is that fuel coming from?
I don't know. Honestly, I think I was born with it, because my mum said that, like, when I was in the womb, I was like, when she'd play music, I'd be kicking along to it. And then, like, when I was like 2 years old, I figured out how to work the stereo on the house and could press play and rewind at the track. And I don't know, there's something inside of me which has to make music. I don't know, so I don't know where that drive comes from. I guess maybe it's because at this point in my career, I don't really have a backup plan, so it has to work.
This is Gem Archer, and you're listening to the Stage Left podcast.
So, Sally can wait, but you don't when you said about being 13 and you're like, oh, I'm not famous yet, like, obviously, you are the band that coined the phrase everybody wants to be famous. What did you want to be remembered for at that age? Like, was it being in a rock band?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Back then, I was like rock, full up like rock music. Yeah, I was like, yeah, rock, and I was just starting to get into pop punk. So, yeah, that kind of stuff. A bass worn very low, playing heavy music. Yeah.
Nice. So what we're going to do now is we are going to bring in our emerging artist, which is Seb. Seb is involved in loads of really interesting musical projects, and is on this kind of upward curve, and eventually we'll get to where you are, I'm sure, Toucan. So Seb has got some questions too, from Seb's perspective.
What's up, Seb?
Hey, how you doing?
What's going on?
Thanks for that. It's great to listen to that chat. thanks again. Like, I just remember when I heard Something for Your Mind, and I was just like, shit, I wish I made that. That's fucking cool.
Thank you.
It was just like a really cool moment. I just think like, firstly, I feel like you come from that lineage of like, I don't know if it's just me in my mind, like putting together these artists. I mean, some of them do collaborate, but it's kind of like the Becks, the St. Vincents, the like, you know, gorillas like Sophie, Kimbra, AJ Cook, Unknown Middle Orchestra, Tori Moi, Jay Paul, you know, Muramasa, like...
Yeah, things we all like. Yeah, lots of them are.
Yeah, it's like this weird pop club, which I fucking, like, I just think is so cool. And maybe, like, weird pop's kind of gotten a bit more, you know, like, accepted and stuff.
With hyperpop becoming, like, really popular, I mean, it's kind of a different thing. Yeah. But yeah, weird pop is kind of, that's what kind of how I think about music, I guess.
Well, I suppose, yeah, because like this sort of, I'm really interested with like some of these people that, sorry, it's my ADHD. Name is scatterbrain, but basically.
It's interesting, a lot of people that you mentioned are all solo artists.
Yeah.
Not bands.
That's true.
So that's interesting.
Well, because I was going to ask you, like, are you consciously trying to be an inventor? Or is it just something you naturally do, like with being weird, you know, or being sort of not the normal pop thing?
I guess we try and make our stuff be unique. Like, obviously everyone wears their influences on their sleeves, I think, but it's important to us to try and do something unique with it.
And like you personally as well, like...
I definitely, it's definitely important to, you know, do something that is pushing a boundary, and, you know, obviously you can't do anything that's like 100% unique, I think. It's, you know, but I was lucky enough to meet Mike Skinner from The Streets once, and he gave me a very good piece of advice that you don't have to be good, you just have to be unique.
I suppose I just feel like some people come at it from different angles. Talking to a mate the other day, and like, you know, even though we're mates and we love a lot of the same stuff, he's really politically driven, and you know, it's not like I'm not a little bit, but I think I just like being an inventor, and so it's I think it's conscious, and I was kind of wondering if it was the same. And just, I suppose, with that, like, because there's always going to be pressures, I imagine, that come from I remember my mate, you know, Fagan, talking about with Kimber and stuff, all those pressures and just different things like that that can happen, like when you do that second album, you get labeled as sort of weird or groundbreaking, like, but you're sort of also put into a box. Like, how do you mentally deal with that? Like, are you going, well, we're just going to fuck everyone off and do something completely different? Or do we like that we've kind of just arrived in this weird box? Does that make sense? Like,
we got categorized, we seem to get categorized with a lot of the, you know, there's that kind of like female led grunge kind of thing. We were kind of put in that box, like an indie rock box, which we were always kind of like, oh, that's interesting, because we definitely see it as like pop, electronic, and not rock. I don't think that impacted the second record, and we just wanted to make what we wanted to make. I think that if you start trying to guess what an audience might want, that probably ends up being a slippery slope where you actually won't deliver what they want. And yeah, it's got to be genuine, I think. And I don't know, for us, that this is just kind of what came out.
Yeah.
But I'd say it's like a very emo record, because we had, like, the touring experience was amazing, but it was very tough.
Right.
And it was hard on Arno, and that's, she sings a lot about that.
Okay, I'll give you like a really quick question here. Like, if you think about textures and stuff, because I feel like you're a very textural band. Maybe this is like looking to your new stuff or whatever, like as in like stuff you haven't made yet or stuff that's in the works. Organic versus plastic.
Ooh. I mean, I think we like to combine those things or take something organic and turn it into plastic or even the other way around. I guess that's kind of why we like to, you know, like use virtual instruments in a computer, but then also plug in like actual instruments and then also mic up the bath and splash some water around them. You know, use little like tinky bell things and stuff like that. It's probably giving people something a bit unexpected and finding things that haven't been like put together before and present them in a new way. I think that's kind of a fun thing to do rather than just using the same sound palette. Because I mean, if you, especially with like plugins, everyone's kind of got the same stuff. So as soon as you kind of use that as a foundation, but then add a few little organic bits into it, it ends up often being more unique. Like I think a lot of like rock music is there's a lot of sample replacement where everyone's using the same sorts of samples and everyone's drums just sound the same. But like when you normally mic up a kit, it's often quite unique and different, but then people try and meld that back into sounding just like a uniform, the same thing. So again, we generally don't use real drum sounds usually, but we try and like use ring modulators or weird stuff to give them a weird like filter or just to make them more interesting, like ear candy, make them a bit, you know, so every snare hit's not the same because like a ring mod is going up or down on it or something like that, or blending in like a mouth sample of like a beatbox sample with the snare or something, I don't know, or like a can opening, or Everybody Be Famous has a camera shutter clicking. That's the snare.
Hey, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
I'll hand it back to Chris.
Can't wait to see what we end on.
Cool. Thanks. Cheers, Seb. Big question here for you, Toucan. If the world ended tomorrow, if you were to find out the world was ending tomorrow, what would be your biggest regret musically?
Ooh. I don't know. I could probably give you two answers. One would be like, oh, I haven't had a Grammy yet or something. But realistically, like, I'd say no regrets. I've got to have this amazing experience that I'm very thankful for. And if the world ended tomorrow, I would have been like, well, damn, at least I got the chance to do that.
It's an interesting one because you mentioned about the Grammy there. I don't know if you've seen the video that James Blake did with Phineas, and it's kind of this concept that he wins a Grammy, James Blake wins a Grammy, and then he's constantly looking over his shoulder and like Phineas has got five. And it's like...
someone's always got more.
Exactly, right? So that's kind of one thing. But is there anything kind of like any particular piece of music you think, oh, I never got around to finishing that or finishing that project?
Oh man, I got a huge folder of that. Definitely. Yeah.
What's stopping you finishing those pieces of work?
It's probably collaboration. Again, as I say, I'm not a lyricist or a singer, and so it's kind of finding the right people to work with on them. And then finding the time, I'm busy, so it's hard to find time to do that. Plus, you know, it's been hard with, you know, not meeting people over the COVID period. You know, there've been lots of like Zoom dates, you know, trying to like collaborate with people, but it's just so strange. You know, I kind of missed that person, at least working with people, that personal contact was quite nice, at least for creation of music, rather than, again, if you know people already, it's different, but like meeting people for the first time on Zoom is a bit strange.
Isn't that interesting of all people to say that, given that Superorganism, in many ways, many of you did meet online for the first time in person, not all of you, but some of you did. That's so interesting.
Yeah, we did, but it wasn't like Zoom kind of things, and it wasn't like let's make music straight away. It was kind of like on message boards and stuff and being like, oh, we've got shared interests, and then running into each other at a show or at a party and being like, oh, hey, you're that person, and then...
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's a new world, isn't it, having to do this all this stuff on Zoom. And
it's crazy.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
It's kind of shortening barriers in many ways. What do you think is one kind of underrated skill that you think every musician should have? So not just being good at your instrument, but what's one kind of thing that you would say is that's an underrated skill that every musician should have to be able to get to where you got to?
I think every musician should be able to demo their own music. And it doesn't have to sound great, but they should be able to demo it. And I'm always amazed when you meet musicians and they're like, yeah, I play guitar. And it's like, oh, so do you record anything? And they're like, no. They have no idea how to work GarageBand or anything. I think that is kind of insane. Like, yeah. Yeah, so you should absolutely learn how to demo stuff. And like, if you want to kind of get really good at recording, that's going to be a different thing. And that takes up a lot of time. And maybe that's not worth doing, but just being able to kind of plug a mic into your laptop and actually put an idea down, and like, I think that's really important. Because you can always tell musicians who never recorded, because they're never as like good as they think they are, because they've never like listened back and been like, oh, actually, maybe I need to work on that or something like that. You know, they won't develop their ideas. They'll just kind of like be on the fly and they'll do their idea out, and that's it, you know. So yeah, I think that's, I mean, this is coming from a point of view of someone who loves recording, but yeah. Yeah, I would definitely put effort into learning how to do basic demos.
I don't know if you saw during COVID, Lady Gaga arranged this kind of this show where people recorded from home, and you had like super, super well-known kind of artists, and it really highlighted how dependent they are on good engineers to get good sound quality, because they were doing it themselves yep. on their cameras and
yeah,
stuff like
there
that.
Was,
and it
there was
like,
a lot of, yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of different stuff like that, which, yeah, it was interesting to see everyone's home studios as well. And you're like, ooh, you're doing well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very interesting stuff. What's obviously, you're kind of a gifted and kind of celebrated musician within, you know, a super organism. You're doing some great stuff. What bad habits do you have musically? You know, is it a technical thing? What are bad habits that you have that you teach a young musician not to do?
Bad habits. Yeah, maybe like not finishing musical ideas. I think that's something that a lot of people have. It's really important to be able to do that. I mean, obviously we finish some stuff, but it's, and at the same time, you can't like hold off new ideas because you haven't finished the old ones. You should always let the new ideas flow. But yeah, it's important to try and finish stuff, and that can be hard sometimes.
So this highlights something I just want to kind of begin to wrap up and finish on, is democracy within a band. So, you know, if you look at, there's some bands that have been around for decades, that take a U2, for instance, like somehow they still don't argue, or if they do, it doesn't, you know, break up the band. But there's so many examples of great bands who try to do things in a democratic way and they break up, and it's such a shame because so much good music is lost, right?
Yeah.
Again, as we said earlier, like Sgt. Pepper's, we could have like great, great albums that are just never heard. What advice would you give to young musicians in bands to remain, you know, to compartmentalize the friendship from the work and to hopefully have that longevity that Super Organism will have going forward, to ensure that good music isn't lost because of arguments, essentially?
Yeah, I mean, it is hard to work with people, and I think it's a skill that you need to develop. Like, work with a load of different people and you'll end up filtering people out, and work with people who are like-minded and easy to work with. It's good to be able to compliment each other, like, in terms of not all very nice, more like, you know, being able to do things that they can't do. And, you know, like originally, I guess I wasn't really a writer. And so my whole thing was like, I need to find really good writers because I can do the engineering and production side of it, and I'll team up with them. And so it's kind of finding the bits that you're missing, maybe, because, but then like some of the really creative people, obviously it's pretty stereotypical, have, you know, big egos, and it can be a little bit difficult to deal with. So you've got to try and balance those relationships out in the band. And it's tough. It just comes down to kind of your personal relationships. And yeah, I can imagine it's tough when you've got like bands with some very strong characters who make good creative work, but they clash. I mean, I've been in bands like that where we've had people in those situations, and yeah, it just doesn't last. You make some cool stuff and then it just ends up fizzling out. And you could say it's a shame, but I guess music was made so cool. It wasn't meant to be.
Really interesting, because with that in mind, you've said specifically there about getting on well with people, or easy to work with, actually, is what you said. This easy to work with. What makes someone easy to work with from your perspective?
I mean, I try and be as easy to work with as possible, and like as accommodating as possible, and, you know, offer. I guess you've got to kind of pick your battles sometimes as well. Like, I mean, there's a politeness, I guess, which is important. I mean, I think this is maybe a British or New Zealand thing of being like, you know, you're quiet and polite and that kind of thing, which I guess maybe in an American session wouldn't go down so well because they're often like jumping off the walls being like, whoa, like crazy idea, man. Can you like reframe?
I think it's really interesting to see what the specifics are that are going to create that dynamic. So if the specifics are that you get on well with people or they're easy to work with, what does easy to work with actually entail? Is it just yes people? Does it say, yeah, okay, that's fine, or I'm quite chilled about however that sounds? Or is it they have a really clear vision and they're really focused and said, this is exactly what I want,
I mean,
and that makes them easy to work with?
That can be great too. I guess like if you're the person who's like a facilitator, you can work with someone with a really strong vision to help them create that vision. But then sometimes if you try and interject and put your own thing in, they push back on you. And I guess it's if you're willing to let some of that go, that can work. But if you're not, then that's when the clashes start happening. So I guess it's just the balance of the characters and stuff. And, you know, people, I'd say that not living with your bandmates is probably a good idea. Because we all lived together for quite a while, and that was fun for a bit, but it started to impact the relationships, and so we had to stop for the sake of the band and the sake of our friendships. You know, because getting off a tour bus and then suddenly being like in the same kitchen as your bandmates is actually not that healthy, I think.
That's not sustainable.
No, especially after you've already lived together for like 5+ years before that in a flat or whatever. So, I mean, yeah, I think You just got to try working with different people, and just some will stick and some won't. And, you know, some people you'll make good friends with, but you'll figure out that you don't work creatively with them well. Or, yeah, I don't know. I just try and be easygoing and friendly and get along with everyone. Maybe non-confrontational.
Good advice. And, yeah. And another project.
But then again, if you have a super strong idea, I can understand if you've, like, it's frustrating when you've got like a really strong opinion of how something could be and the other collaborators are like, no, we don't like that. And you're like, ah, damn it. So I guess you got to know when to fight for your idea. I'm very accommodating. I'll always at least let people try the idea. I think it's important not to like shut someone down before they've tried the idea, because it just ruins their confidence or their enthusiasm for the project. You know, better to let them try it, and then you can be like, yeah, well, it doesn't work maybe for these reasons. I think it's important to let people be creative.
Now, listen, before we go, there's one project that I want to ask you about. So We had two members of the collective who actually aren't with the band anymore. So we had Andrew and we had Fraser from Jungle. And
Did some
work with Jungle. So you mixed, I think, like 8 tracks. Is that right?
12 of 14 tracks on Loving in Stereo, which came out in 2021.
What are your fondest memories of that process and working with those guys?
It was all remote. I mean, I've met them quite a lot, but it was all done remote. And it was like the height of COVID and it was winter. I was sitting in my little mix room just working on it, like 2 songs a day. It was great working on that. That was really fun. Like, those guys just know what they want and like they have such a vibe to their kind of stuff, and it's already kind of very much baked in there. Like, it was just a case of like refining and balancing stuff. It gave me like a newfound, I mean, I always liked them, but it gave me a real newfound appreciation for their music, like, and how the balance of it all works. It's an interesting sound because like there's like kind of, it's the blend, like nothing, no one element stands out. Like, obviously they've got vocals, but it's a group vocal and it's not like a pop vocal that's like way on top of the mix. Everything blends in, and if any one thing stands out, it's kind of not their sound anymore. It's really interesting, really interesting. And it's like very, it's vintagey without being throwback, which is interesting too. Like, my tendency is to kind of hype things up and kind of, you know, make the kick fat and all that kind of stuff. And it was, I remember the first mix, they were like, oh, great, but you've gone too far with this. And I had to really like show restraint to kind of keep it. I don't want to use the word old school because they're not doing something that's throwback or pastiche. It's like, it's modern, but it's taking a lot of vintage influence. So yeah, I learned a lot doing that and it's been really successful. So that's really cool.
What's one thing you think everybody should know about the music industry that you didn't know entering it?
It's very easy to, like, I think it's important, like, if you kind of get yourself into the industry to, like, maintain the relationships and not try and, because you'll quickly get in your head and think, oh, people don't like me or something like that. Whereas, yeah, it's actually, from my experience, it's been a very friendly place and not at all how a bunch of people on the internet seem to describe it.
Wow, really? That's good to hear. That's so nice to hear a positive answer to that question.
That's from the position of, you know, being in a band that's kind of quite quickly been successful and done reasonably well, I guess. So I appreciate that I'm in a position that's different than some. But plus, our record label's awesome. You know, Domino, they're super nice people. They're really friendly. They're great to work with. And we're very lucky. Yeah, it's honestly been a great experience. And yeah, I would say everyone's that I've come across has just been really friendly and cool. And I think it's important to make sure that if you get in, to foster those relationships and, like, not start sitting at home and second guessing what maybe people think.
Man.
Yeah.
It's really good advice. And a very, very, very interesting, and a very, very interesting answer to that particular question. Because sometimes it's quite, people answer that question with quite a lot of negativity, and it's kind of interesting to see that actually that there is kind of a positive way to look at that. I guess the next question is going to be an interesting one. Is the music industry fair? And if not, and you were president of the music industry for one day, what laws would you create to make it more fair?
I mean, it's not fair. It's a popularity contest at the end of the day, isn't it? So it's not fair. You can work your life making something that you think's really good, and if no one likes it, well then, well, no one hears about it. Is it fair? Oh, that's it's very hard to make a living in music. A lot of people try and not many people actually get to do it. But is that fair? I think we've just done a bunch of touring, and touring is now in the current climate very tough because everything has gone up in price. Absolutely everything, you know, fuel, hotels, everything. But the amount you get paid to do a show is kind of the same as it used to be. So you can, like, bust your ass off touring around and kind of break even. So is that fair? But then if you're more popular and you keep your production costs down, you can make money. So I mean, again, it's in terms of your popularity. So nah, straight up, music industry is not fair and there's nothing you can do about it. Like, if you want to play the game, it's unfair and it's tough, and you have to have the passion and drive to want to do it, and it's unfair. I'm optimistic for me. I guess the cost of entry to get into it, like, I spent, like, my entire 20s working a day job, putting all my spare time into music before I could actually make it a career. That's, for a lot of people, that's going to be what it takes. I mean, you know, there are some people who have parents who can fund them and can get into it quicker. And I think going forward, you're going to see, I mean, that's already the case with a lot of the music industry, but you're going to see more of that, I think, because it's just, again, like, if you can't make money from it, then how do you do it as a job unless something else can pay you? So that'll be interesting. But yeah.
It's a big question. Yeah. It's a big question. Yeah. And you've mulled over it beautifully. I mean, it's a difficult one, right? And I think what you're right, saying that going forward, people who, and that's going to create an inequality, actually, in some ways, if it's like, okay, rich parents can pay for, well, you know, the kids to make music, and, like, where does that leave us as a culture going forward? But that's a
question. But I mean, that's been the case since the beginning of the music industry, really. Like, how many well-known artists have got parents with a Wikipedia page about their art they used to make or whatever? You know, it's very common, and I don't hold that against anyone at all. Loads of great artists have come from that background. But it definitely makes it hard for people who don't have that. Yeah.
Now, listen, let's begin to wrap up there. I just want to say thank you so much for your time time you're taking to answer these questions to be really, really reflective and kind of analytical, and it's providing really juicy stuff that's going to help the next musician who's going to be in your shoes going forward.
Thank you. I'm glad about that. I hope I'm not like ranting too much about some bullshit. You know,
no, not at all. What's next? So what's this year got in hold for you or in plans for you?
I've got a few records I'm mixing at the moment. I can't say who.
Fair enough.
Yeah, sorry. And then a few other projects I'm working on. I'm going to be doing a bit of production. Again, like I was saying before, I haven't really done much production outside of my own bands, but I'm doing a little bit of that this year, so that'll be fun. So, yeah, I'm just going to make a bunch of music, produce a bunch of music, mix a bunch of music, listen to a bunch of music.
Well, listen, thank you for your wisdom, your insight, the fact you shared so much with us. You know, you're only on an early stage in kind of your journey, and you're going to produce and be involved in so much great music going forward. So thank
you. That's the hope.
Our future ears, thank you for the music you're going to be producing. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on, so thanks for being such a great guest.
Yeah, thanks so much, Chris. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.